Okay. So I want to talk about some work that we've done on algorithms. They happen to be randomized, but if you don't like randomization, you can think of randomization as just a way to extract structure instead of the identification of where that structure is, because I'll also talk about some applications, and some of those applications will use non-randomized, or I don't want to say de-randomized because that's a loaded term in algorithms, but non-randomized variants of what I'll be talking about. Now the algorithms will provide, I guess, if you want to call it a definition or a characterization of a data-driven dictionary. Dictionary meaning, you know, basis. It really comes from the data, in quite literally from the data.
Completely relevant question.
Do
you really plan to have a title that all words begin with D?
I tried to, but I had to have the subword or whatever you call that.
So you'll of course tell us what all those things mean.
So a way to define or characterize a dictionary or a basis that really is in terms of the data. We'll be dealing with matrices, so data means columns and rows, as opposed to, say, linear combinations of them that may or may not mean something. We'll solve all your problems. I mean, I'll apply in a number of different domains. I'm currently at Yahoo. I moved there about 4 or 5 months ago. So there's a number of projects with Yahoo-related data, and we could talk offline about that. I was hoping to get some initial results on some of those in order to present, but I wasn't able to get those done in time. And so I'll be talking about some stuff I started before, about 5 or 6 months ago. Not just internet document domains, but these two applications have to do with imaging, spectral or temporally resolved imaging data, and certain DNA data. And if you use whatever your favorite search engine is, this is the web page you'll find, because we're growing quite a bit and haven't had a chance to straighten out the web pages. So I'll keep that active until I'm able to move the web page. This is work with Petros Jurnaeus, Muthu Krishnan. In particular, if you're familiar with some of the old stuff that had additive error approximations, we'll have relative error approximation guarantees. And Muthu was involved with this. There's a number of people, some of whom are here, who are also involved, and I'll point that out as the time progresses. So, now I probably couldn't have asked for a better introduction, actually, than the previous talk for exploring a lot of the ideas that I'll be talking about in maybe a little bit vague sense here. So in a lot of cases, people will study documents or data, will put the data onto a graph or into a vector space. And the reason, effectively, is that's where all the tools are. And so even if the data don't actually naturally, obviously, live in those places, people go to a lot of effort to jam them into those places and then perform graph or vector space operations in order to extract information and learn something from the data. Because of this step, oftentimes the data will have structure, non-negativity, sparsity, any of a number of other sorts of structure that will be unrelated to the graphical or linear algebraic structure that's implicit in where you're modeling the data. The structure may or may not be difficult to formalize. It's a sparsity and non-negativity notion. It's not, but in other cases it may be hard to formalize. And an important point about this structure is that if you're a practitioner or you talk to practitioners, you'll find that they oftentimes will have extensive intuition about the data that's peculiar to the field from which the data is drawn. All right? In some cases, this intuition is used to choose where the data live, where you put the data, what exactly the space is. In other cases, you'll perform these operations and get some results and then go back and try and use intuition from that area in order to see if the results you got are meaningful in some sense. So we're going to be considering documents that are going to be modeled as matrices. This is a fairly common way to think about documents, by no means unique, but a fairly common paradigm. And it's because if you have n things, and things can be any of a bunch of different things, each of which are described by M features. What are the best features? That's the question that we've heard people talk about. N things, M features, you'll have an M by N matrix A. Now, in a lot of cases, these documents will have some sort of structure. The simplest might be linear structure. And when you think linear structure, you probably think SVD or PCA. Linear structure is really, of course, just redundancy in the rows and columns. It's not SVD. SVD is a tool. PCA is a tool to extract that structure. If there's non-linear structure, you like linear structure so much, you'll kernelize the data and try and apply eigen analysis on kernelized data. And so, for example, a lot of diffusion-based methods will, at a high level, use this sort of idea. An important point related to what I was saying on the previous slide about practitioner's knowledge is, in a lot of cases, you'll know what the rows or columns mean. I don't want to formalize that, but you know what they mean from the application area. For example, you'll have you could have terms and documents. You could have genes and environmental conditions. And if you think about where the data come from, you'll really know what a given gene or a given environmental condition means. Someone down the hall did a lot of work on it, wrote a dissertation or something. So you'll know what the individual rows or columns, if you formulate it as a matrix, you know what the individual rows or columns mean in some intuitive sense, in a way that you might not know, for example, what subsets of the rows or columns or arbitrary linear combinations of the rows or columns mean. Right? What's a linear combination of 6,000 genes mean, 30,000 genes? So the goal here will be to develop algorithms, by which I mean provably accurate algorithms, such that the algorithms community would be happy. Develop provably accurate algorithmic methods. These methods should be agnostic with respect to any particular field, but one can fruitfully couple them with field-specific intuition or understanding. And of course, they should perform well on real or non-toy data sets.
What do you mean by agnostic in this circumstance?
So in this particular circumstance, I don't want to know. I'm going to present a matrix algorithm, and I guess I told you the punchline a minute ago. But you don't know that I'm going to apply it to term document matrices, user good matrices, recommendation system matrices, or genomes, or anything. If I talk to people that do algorithms, I mean they are typically applied to mathematicians in a theorem proving sense, and by which I don't mean PDE people, but theoretical computer science. And they just want, give me an input. It's a matrix. Don't ask where it comes from. So agnostic with respect to any particular field in that sense.
Yeah. But that'd be terrible if you didn't have the next bullet.
Well, this is an ambitious goal.
If you're going to have something that's agnostic with respect to the field, then there has to be some way to prove.
Well, the SVD is good at a lot of things. It makes no claims about the particular field. And to the extent that it's applicable in particular fields, you may or may not be able to do that. But. You'll see that the approximations we have will try to address this in an explicit manner.
I was wondering what provably accurate means, right? For SVD, so you can prove things about best linear approximation for any rank.
Right.
But that doesn't really say anything about correctness with respect to some domain-specific measure like the clustering agreeing with a human clustering.
Right. If you can give me an objective that tells me what humans mean when they cluster, then we can address that here. I mean, at this point, I don't know how to do that.
By provably accurate, you mean with in respect the same sense that SVD is
in the same sense that SVD gives you the optimal rank K approximation with respect to any Unitarian invariant norm, for example. Yeah.
I don't want to bog you down, but just have a quick example of something that is not agnostic with respect to a particular field, I probably understand.
There's a lot of work done, I think, in a range of sort of applied data areas. And I'm thinking of areas that do sort of data as such. And there'll be, you'll get a data set and you'll develop a heuristic that's peculiar to that data set. In a sense, driven by that data set.
And so
what I want to do is develop a method that I don't know the data and then go out and apply it to data. Now obviously I'm not going to show you garbage, and so the data that I choose will be relevant for these methods. But these methods were developed and are being developed sort of before and independent of any particular domain.
You use particular structure of the data matrix that comes because they're documents or speech data. And because of that, it usually has this property, and so this trick is what you want.
So like an example would be the Mumford-Shaw algorithm in segmentation of images. That you wouldn't use if you weren't in a 2 or 3D situation trying to segment something that was supposed to be spatially contiguous.
All right, so is everyone happy, or at least satisfied?
Happy.
All right, well, that's all that matters.
Right,
so
there you go.
Oh, now I'm happy.
Some of the things we've thought about do involve kernelizations of some of these, but let me for a moment just deal with linear structure today. And we can talk offline about generalizations if you like. But for right now, we're dealing with a matrix A, and I want you to think about the SVD. And if you've seen the SVD 100 times, I want to ask you to bear with me, because I want to talk about some aspects of it that are not immediately obvious, but are very nice and intuitively appealing and will help us to get a number of non-obvious results. An orthogonal matrix, diagonal rescaling matrix, the basis for one side, basis for the other side, conditioned on the two bases, the basis in the domain and the basis in the range. This is A. So this is subspace, this is subspace information, that's just A, conditioned on those two bases. The minimum row is, of course, the rank. We're going to be thinking of situations where row is small, or by choosing some K, we can capture most of A. If you know about PCA and not SVD, if this is a correlational matrix, that'll be a U and this will be DCA. So this is the mathematics that will underline that. And the exact computation will take big O of n cubed time. Big O in an inequality sense, but you know, meaning some cases you can do better, but something like that. So if you truncate by keeping the top k terms, and the theorems I'll present will be true in general, but they'll be most appropriate when the matrices are well approximated by a low rank matrix. So you should keep that in the back of your mind. It means we can choose, with respect to the SVD, this isn't necessarily the definition, but with respect to the SVD, what that means is you can choose a parameter k and keep just k of those terms. This will give an approximation A sub k that is the best in a certain precise sense for any unitarily invariant norm. What I want you to note is this truncated version of U. If we have a low rank approximation here, what that means is that this U sub k is very rectangular, right? M and N are high dimensions, k is the rank parameter, and it's something small. So this is very rectangular. I probably should have had that go down and down. I mean, so it's very rectangular. And in that case, what we're going to want to think about is the lengths of the rows of U. By lengths, I mean Euclidean norms. So for a sanity check here, we have a truncated orthogonal matrix. Throw out a bunch of columns, keep a small number of columns. What are the lengths, Euclidean norms of each of those columns? This is easy, it's a sanity check, it's one. What about each of those rows? What's the length? What can you tell me about the length of the Euclidean norm of each of those rows? And intuitively, what does it mean? Mm-hmm. And I guess anyone except Carrie and Stefan and maybe Andrew can answer, because they've already been given the answer.
Smarter than
well, I guess I put it on the slide.
Yeah, it's up there, Mike.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, the lengths of the rows are not orthogonal and not unit length. And in fact, they can be any more or less anything between 0 and 1. I'll put an example up on the next slide. And what I want to say is that the lengths of the rows of UK will capture a notion of information dispersal. I'll give you a proof by interpolation. I'll nail down the two endpoints and claim that everything else falls in between. So what do the lengths of these rows mean? N by D, or row, K. Very rectangular matrix. So let's consider two possible matrices of length singular vectors. All right. One is the identity. Take the identity, throw out most of the columns, keep k of them. What are the lengths of the columns? Certainly they're all one. What are the lengths of the rows?
Zero.
They're either zero or one. Very non-uniform if you think of it as a distribution over the lengths of the rows. What does the identity, IN slash k, those k columns, for length zero, and what does the identity do when it operates on a vector x? So it throws out a bunch of things and maybe shuffles them around, but aside from that, it doesn't do anything. All right? So very uninteresting stuff going on here and a very non-uniform distribution over here. Now let's think about the Hadamard matrix. The Hadamard matrix is 1, 1, 1, negative 1, normalized, appropriately, and recursively defined. All right? It's orthogonal, so it's normalized to be orthogonal. And what are the lengths? If you don't know what this is, think of it as a real version of the Fourier matrix. You have this thing, keep a small number of columns of this thing. The lengths of the rows are all, sorry, the lengths of the columns are all one. What are the lengths of the rows? So all the elements are unit length, but we normalize them to be 1 over n or root n or whatever. If you keep just k of the columns, all the columns are k over n or k over root n, and they're all the same length. what does the Hadamard do when it hits a vector x? If you don't know what that what it does, think of what the Fourier transform does when it hits a vector x. Right? If it hits a vector x, a delta function, say, it will turn it into a cosine. It will maximally disperse. And if it hits a cosine, it will turn it into a delta function. So conditional on what you know before, you've maximally dispersed the original information. And what you have here is a very uniform distribution over row lengths. So we have evidence, and this will be the interpolation step. And so I'd like to formalize this a little bit more, but I don't have the formalization done. But think of any k columns from a general orthogonal matrix. The row lengths will be between 0 and 1. And the lengths of those rows will characterize the notion of information dispersal. All right? A is equal to U times sigma times V transpose. Conditioned on the two bases, A is just at singular values. So this will give you a notion of where in Rn, the high dimensional space, where the information in A, its singular values, are being sent, independent of what that information is. All right? You can change the singular values, and you'll still send the information to the same place. So you got to keep that in the back of your mind, because that's not an obvious thing, but we'll get back to that for the relative error results I'll talk about in just a moment. Problem with SVD and eigenanalysis, and the reason we'll get back to that is I want to improve upon certain properties here that may be problematic with the SVD. The problems, insofar as there are some, and I'm not talking about if the matrix is full rank. Obviously, if the matrix is full rank, I mean, none of this was relevant. So say you have a low rank matrix, because the data are that way or because you've kernelized it. One problem that statisticians are very aware of, but maybe other people are not, is reification. The maximum variance in directions in the data are just that. All right. If the world is nice and the data come from a Gaussian distribution, the various directions tell you something about the axes of this distribution. The world's not nice, and so you'll probably see some data set like this. I mean, hell, you may see some curvy thing. But, you know, you'll see something like this. The maximum variance direction will be that. There's up to noise, no elements in the data set that align along that axis. And this is the maximum variance direction conditional on being perpendicular to that. All right? This is a problem if, in social sciences, you interpret the singular vectors the wrong way. Internet documents and bacterial DNA and so on don't complain, but you're guilty of the same sin if you reify. So we don't want to be doing that. Interpretability. These methods are ultimately going to be coupled with the data analyst. And so insofar as it's possible, you'd like to take advantage of the analyst's intuition, precisely because you can't formalize what it means to be good in an intuitive sense. You don't know what a linear combination of 6,000 units. Sparsity. Say you have large term document matrices. All right? Yahoo has, you know, 10 to the 10 of them, some incredible number. Large term document matrices. They're very sparse. If you have a million by million matrix, you don't have a million squared elements. You have 10 million, maybe, or 100 million. If you, and oftentimes these things are low rank. Let me put aside heavy tail issues for a moment. If you do an orthogonalization using a lot of negative signs, you'll kill the sparsity. If you keep a rank 10 or 100 approximation, you're keeping as many bits as in the original data. So you don't want to be doing that. Non-negativity. A lot of times, there's non-negativity structure on the data. And when you do SVD, you need cancellation, you're introducing a lot of negative signs. So you'll damage that. So these are, you know, problems that will arise fairly frequently. And oftentimes people do SVD and try and work their way around it. Generalized SVD, you know, in a feature space, you know, whatever. But these will apply more generally than just SVD with low rank. If you go to a feature space, if you do so-called generalized SVD, any of a number of other things. So the SVD will give you a low rank approximation with a very particular structure. Rotation, rescaling, rotation. And the question is, similar to the question I had on the slide a couple slides ago, do there exist, in some sense, better low-rank matrix approximations, better structural properties for certain or wide range of applications, better maybe at representing the relevant structure, better for interpretability or informing intuition? So that's what we want to talk about. Yes?
So I just wanted to comment that the sparse is not necessarily orthogonalization, but it's probably sparsity.
Well, that's one thing that you might.
You might. And it's very hard to orthogonalize them and change sparsity.
Right.
It's not strictly the orthogonalization. It's in general, just trying to factorize can destroy sparsity by itself.
True.
Orthogonalization
true.
Makes it even harder.
True. Yeah, the other factorizations may true. So we're going to be talking about dictionaries. And just two dictionaries to keep in the back of your mind. One I mentioned. discrete Fourier transform, you have a function and you want to write it on a basis. The basis is given to you. The basis is fixed, and it takes n squared or n log n computation time to determine coefficients. All right. Think of this as a dictionary. All right. You open up a dictionary. These are the words. You write your function on the words with those coefficients, and it takes some amount of time to determine them. What the SVD does is exactly the same thing. That will give you a dictionary of rank one matrices. The goal, though, is to determine the dictionary and the coefficients. So you need to determine actually those rank one matrices and the coefficients, and it takes a bit more time. And you can imagine other sorts of dictionaries. So you might ask, since you have intuition about the data points, et cetera, by et cetera, you know, you have intuition about the data points, it'll map onto what the practitioner understands, there may be noise issues or sparsity issues. You may ask, can I use actual data points? By data points, I mean columns or rows, features or vectors, so I'm being symmetric there. Can I use actual data points and or feature vectors to be the dictionary? So this has gone by, this sort of paradigm has gone by the name core sets in the algorithms community when applied to graph theoretic problems. And what core sets will mean is a small number of nodes such that you can solve some particular problem. Mm-hmm. So some particular problem, usually to relative error. So we talked about CUR decomposition some number of years ago. Same sort of idea applied to matrices, except the error was rather coarse, an additive error. So the answer to this will be yes, using a CUR framework on matrices. And I'll talk about the relative error and then talk about applying it in a couple settings. So the next two slides are also stuff you've seen with SVD, but I'm going to develop a low-rank approximation in terms of the actual columns and rows. And so I want to draw an analogy. So this everyone should know, but I'll draw an analogy in the next slide to all these things. Just to show you that, see, not much has changed except everything. Exactly. So A is equal to U sigma V transpose. You have eigenrows and eigencolumns, linear combinations of, in general, all the columns and rows. So say I give you a bunch of those eigenrows or eigencolumns, and I want to, say, fit a new column. A super J is a new column of J, the J column of A. I want to fit that column as a linear combination of just these, probably a small number of these. And the coefficients are z, and maybe minimizing, let's say, an L2 norm. We're thinking about L1s and L infinities, but for today we'll talk about L2s. Well, the solution is z is equal to uk transpose a, those singular vectors hitting a, in which case the approximation a, and now we're viewing it just from a column perspective, just from an eigencolumn perspective, a is approximately equal to ak is a projection onto those columns of the original matrix. So from column perspective, you're projecting onto just those columns. Now let's view it from a row perspective. Z is, in fact, in this case, exactly, more generally could be approximately, but exactly also equal to sigma sub k vk transpose, in which case you're approximating a by a sub k. What you're doing is taking every row, every column here, and using a small number of rows and some encoding information to write every other column. So you're expressing every other column in terms of the basis set, in terms of a small number of rows of the actual matrix, and some encoding information. The encoding information happens to be diagonal here, but it's some encoding information. So viewed from that perspective, and recalling that the U's are just a basis for the column space, exact or approximate, and the V's are just a basis for the row space, exact or approximate, let's try and express A as C times U, no relation to the SVD U, it's just some low-dimensional matrix. C times U times R. C is a bunch of columns of A. R is a bunch of rows, actual columns and actual rows times some low-dimensional encoding. So say we're given a small number of columns. C sub I is some column of A. And we want to choose some other column of A and fit it in an L2 sense to that basis. And there's going to be some coefficients Y here, analogous to the Z before. Minimize this expression, and you'll get C plus A. What we had before was U plus A, except U's orthogonal, so it's U transpose A. But we get C plus A, and when you plug that in here, it's C, C plus A. That's a projection onto the column space of C, exactly as before, a projection onto the column space of U. This is in terms of those columns. You can project onto those actual columns. That's what Y is to solve this problem. Y is not exactly here, but approximately, in a sense we can make precise. Not C plus A, but let's call it W plus R. If you have those columns, choose a small number of rows. And if you have the matrix A, choose the same small number of rows. And I'll have some pictures coming up in just a minute to show you sort of pictorially what that means. But what you're doing now, plug y plus r here, and you're going to get a is close to this projection, is c times some low-dimensional encoding thing, w plus, the pseudo-inverse of the intersection of those rows and columns, times r. So what you're doing is approximating every column of A in terms of a small number of actual rows and a low-dimensional encoding matrix. So it parallels the SVD.
Approximating, but in terms of actual rows.
In terms of actual rows. So the SVD in a low-rank sense will give you this sort of thing, U sigma V transpose. K, I guess, everywhere. C, actual columns. Give you basically the column space. Let me say script U, totally unrelated to that, which is actually exactly or approximately, depending on the framework you're dealing with, W plus. So if you have the original matrix A, let's put all the columns we choose on the left and all the rows on the top. So these are the columns, those are the rows. W is just the intersection between the two. Some encoding matrix R. AK equals that. The question is, can we formalize a sense in which this is approximately equal to that? And the reason we want to compare to that is just because that's the best in the unitary norm sense. But it's also written in terms of actual columns and rows. If we can formalize that in some sense, and we will be able to, but if we can formalize that in some sense, then what we have here is a low-dimensional approximation spectrum in terms of actual columns and actual rows. If there's sparsity on the data, those columns and rows will be sparse. If there's non-negativity on the data, those columns and rows will be sparse. That will not be sparse. But if you choose k small, you'll be okay. That will not be non-negative, but I think, let's call it c times x, where x is equal to c plus a. I think we can put non-negativity there, but we don't have that. So I'll mention that later, but I'm not 100% sure we can
do
that.
Who says you can do this and get the squiggly lines mean is close to?
I do.
Oh, you're...
And I'll show that.
Okay.
Yeah. So this is a high level to sort of paint the picture, but that's the point, that I'll quantify that and, to the extent possible, present examples. So let me skip that. But point out, just recall that SVD will give you rotation, rescaling, rotation. If I can formalize it, which I will, this will give you a low-rank approximation. But it's not really a rotation. There's singular value structures just in the middle matrix here. The singular values information in the R and the C. So it's got to be inverse of singular value information. Very different structural properties, but also low rank.
So to make this a little bit more concrete, so you have some, it's a document term matrix.
Yeah.
It takes some documents.
Correct.
Some terms.
Right.
And a U.
Small number of actual documents, small number of actual terms, and their intersection. If you're dealing with a recommendation system, for example, most of this information, so for term document matrices, there's zeros in a lot of places. With recommendation systems, there's missing entries in a lot of places. There's actually missing entries here, so I don't know how to deal with that yet. But there's missing entries in a lot of places. And so you don't actually, if I can figure out how to deal with that, you don't actually need all this information, which is n squared, omega of n squared information, in order to get a low rank approximation. For the SVD, you need the full matrix, you need to compute some way.
Can you say, there's something I'm still missing about the intersection of rows and columns.
Yeah.
What do you mean by rows and columns and their intersection? At first I was thinking, okay, there's some column whose transpose is equal to...
No, say I choose these three columns, because these ones I don't choose, right? I choose these three. I don't need to choose three. I choose these four rows.
Yep.
Not these. Mm-hmm. This is a 3x4 matrix of their intersection.
And what are we doing with the intersection?
Well, let's call this 3x4 matrix W.
Okay, so W is that matrix, and we haven't used it yet.
W is what you put in between the pseudo inverse of W.
Thank you. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes. So I'll run through a bunch of things, and if you want to not follow some of the details, that's fine. But hopefully at a high level, it's clear. So is it sort of clear?
It's clear that it would be cool if it's true.
Well, why don't we just go now, because it is. Did you need to be convinced or just be told? All right, so let's, for formality, Cx, I want to call this matrix decomposition C times X. If it's a low-rank approximation, explicitly expressed in terms of a small number of columns. And in particular, if we have a decomposition that's expressed as A is close to C, C plus A, it's explicitly expressed there. And CUR will be if it's explicitly expressed in terms of a small number of columns and rows. Just to, I'll be talking about that later. Columns, encoding, matrix, rows. So let's formalize this a little bit. Let's just think about columns for a moment. All right, columns and rows get complicated, and if we can do columns, you can believe me that we can do rows if you like. So you could ask, fix a rank parameter k. You've got to give me that, so we aren't going to choose that. That's some statistical modeling problem. But if you choose a rank parameter k, you could ask, give me the best, whatever your favorite metric is, give me the best k columns. And unless you choose a very nice, and I don't know what a very nice means, but in a non-trivial sense, but unless you choose a very peculiar measure of merit, you're going to have a combinatorial problem. The algorithm will take n choose k or n to the k time, and so it'll be NP hard. And the reason is that it's just a combinatorial problem. You're not taking advantage of the fact that these things are vectors. You're taking no advantage of linear algebraic information. So rather than doing that, let's fix a rank parameter k, and let's oversample a little bit. Little for the theorems will mean this, or the, well, maybe 100k or k squared. For the theorems, in practice, it'll mean this, or 2 times k. So oversample by a little bit. And what we want to get is close to the best rank k, additive error or relative error. So note what we're doing. We're viewing the error, and we're also viewing the oversampling, in a sense, as computational resources analogous to space and time that we can exploit algorithmically. And that's the way we're going to beat that.
So now you only have to consider k plus 3 to choose k?
We're going to take advantage of some linear algebraic structure. So we're going to be able to do all this in n squared n cubed time. Not obvious, but we will.
So well, it's going to have some
well, let me make it, maybe I didn't understand what you just said about
When I say n, k squared n, for example.
Right, so k squared.
Yeah, sure, okay. But maybe I misunderstood what you were doing for the oversampling. I thought you meant you were going to pick 10k columns. And then you want to choose the k of them that give you the best rank.
No, I live with 10k.
Sorry?
I'll live with 10k.
No, what he wants to do is instead of k, I'm going to
You give me k and I'll oversample it.
Okay. So you're going to have a 10k.
There'll be in general some redundancy.
You're going to have 10k columns which do almost as well as the best k.
Right.
Correct.
And maybe though.
Correct. Yeah. Right. So that's the resource I'm.
Yeah. Okay. No.
So, do there exist? They do, we want algorithms, so can you find them? Do there exist order k or order k squared, order k cubed columns such that a minus cc plus a, if you project onto those columns, you're better than the best rank k, you're not going to beat that, but better than the best rank k plus something, epsilon times some scale factor, the Frobenius norm of a. So do these even exist? So it's not immediately obvious they do. The answer is yes, though, and in fact, you can find them pretty easily. Two passes over the data in linear additional space and time. So if you're familiar with some of this stuff, that's what was done before. You could say this is a pretty coarse scale factor. I'm going to drive that down. Epsilon to the t. Think of epsilon in this case as something small, 0.1. And I want to make it 0.1 to the 10th. T will be the number of passes. But just make it small. Can I decrease this additive error arbitrarily much? And the answer is yes. Linear space and time, t passes. This isn't immediately obvious, but it turns out that it can be done. Do there exist k or k squared or so columns such that a minus cc plus a, the Frobenius norm or spectral norm like here, is within 1 plus epsilon, relative error of the best rank k? All right, here we have a norm of a, pull that down to a minus a sub k. So relative error, good. The answer to this is yes. It was actually first probably, I was in Miami yesterday, and the talk before mine at SOTA was the first sort of public presentation that was true. I'd seen the paper about 8 or 9 months ago, but in preprint. But this is not obvious. An open problem there is, can you actually find them? So we'll get to that.
And why isn't that what I want?
Because they exist. You still have to choose all and choose k, or n choose order k. Back to columns and rows, same questions. Do there exist a small number of columns and rows to get additive error? Yes, if you've seen the previous CUR stuff, the same sort of thing. Linear space and time after a couple passes. Do there exist k or k squared columns and rows to get relative error? All right?
So could you, yeah. So there,
That's regarding randomized algorithms for deterministic algorithms.
So
are you doing that guarantee that error, relative error?
So they have, what I have here is a 1 plus epsilon. There's no what do you call kappa?
Conditions.
There's no condition information and so on in there.
So
right there. There's no conditioning. A lot of the stuff, such as GUI and Eisenstadt's,
yes,
has conditioning information. This is a little bit different, and I'm not still exactly sure how it relates to what they have.
Okay,
but they'll choose a set of rows and columns and have conditioning information. So there's no conditioning information here. There's at least one difference. But
what do you mean conditioning information? Above a single event?
Yeah.
The conditional
information? Yeah.
Right.
So the framework's a little bit different. The statement of the theorem is a bit different. And we have yet to reconcile them, but they're a little bit different. They exist, and I'll give a randomized algorithm. But for example, theirs does not do either this for columns and rows or the previous side. It won't give you order k columns that get within relative error in this sort of provable sense.
I think they do that with a condition on the
eigenvector. Right.
Yes.
Do I get to pick epsilon?
You can pick epsilon if you like.
So I can say how close I want.
For every the theorem will hold for every epsilon greater than zero.
But the penalty
and the
you'll
penalty
pay
is how long.
Right.
So you won't like the first one you get.
Right.
Choose a set of probabilities. We'll get back to that in a minute. Probabilities are where the information is. We're actually thinking about having and so these are going to be a priori proofs, a priori claims. If you establish this, then everything follows. We're actually looking at non-randomizing or de-randomizing it. Choose some set of columns some way, such as theirs, and then if you set a posteriori, if you satisfy those conditions, then these sorts of claims will hold. We don't have that yet. So for a moment, choose some set of probabilities, but this is where the structure is. I'll get to that in a minute. And choose R rows randomly according to those probability distribution. And let's let R be the matrix. What we're doing is we're fixing given C. Don't ask how you get it for a moment. Given a matrix A and a matrix C, choose a bunch of rows of R and choose the same rows of C and put that information in W. So C is given to you and A is given to you. You choose a bunch of rows. Put the rows of A and R and the rows of C in W. Then, given that matrix C in a small amount of time, and this is big O in an inequality sense of SVD. For this, you can do it in M times N. But you're going to have to do an SVD on the matrix. Well, it suffices. I don't know if it's necessary. A minus C times U. These are some diagonal scalings. Don't worry about that. C times U times R is 1 plus epsilon to A minus CC plus A. So if you give me C, I can find rows that are relative error good to those columns. I'll tell you how to get that in a moment. But if you give me a set of columns, I can find rows that are within 1 plus epsilon of the projection of what those columns will do. 1 minus delta is a probability you need to choose C squared. I can reduce that to C. C squared log 1 over delta over epsilon squared.
Okay.
If you don't like epsilon, set it equal to 1. Because these are going to be relevant when we're low rank. But it holds for every epsilon. All right. Now, let me say what the probabilities are. And then I'll describe sort of intuitively what they are. Let's let U equals U sub C be the orthogonal matrix of the left singular vectors of C. And remember, C is a very rectangular matrix. Because we chose a small number of columns, let's say. It doesn't need to be, but that's where this would be most appropriate. And let's let U sub I be the ith row of that matrix of left singular vectors of C. The probabilities are going to have to satisfy something of this form. Now, this is a messy thing. There's three.
In order for the previous result to hold, the probabilities that you said you have to pull out of a hat have to satisfy this.
Probabilities of this form suffice to, suffice to do what we want. So there's three terms here. There's something depending on the row lengths of U. There's something depending on where A sits relative to the column space of C, the column space of U. And there's a cross term. So ignore the cross term. The cross term gives us all the results with high probability. And what we're doing here is saying, given a matrix, given a bunch of columns, we want to fit every column of A to that basis. So think of this as an L2 regression problem. So AX is close to B, and this is very rectangular. If you pad this out to be a full matrix, and change the letters, you're talking about CX equals A. So that's why we're doing this. But AX is close to B. And what we're doing is sampling on the rows. If we're sampling on the rows, we're operating on this side. Right? So we want to pull out a small number of rows. So let's say we're operating with a sampling operator on that side. Now, if we're sampling on A, that's no different than sampling on U sigma V transpose. Remember, change notation. But so I'm also sampling there, if I like. Now, the problem with getting relative error as opposed to additive error is that we're going to have to do a pseudo-inversion. So what we're going to do is take this down. We're going to go to an, this is an n by, let's say, C, I guess, C or K. We're going to go down to a K squared by K, or C squared by C, since I said we need to choose C squared columns. This is 100. This is order. Times X is close to a downsampled version of B. I'm going to solve this exactly, but in order to solve it exactly by taking the pseudo-inverse, I need to make sure I have control over all the singular values, and in particular very small ones. Because if I take the pseudo-inverse and I lose even a little bit, I'll blow that up. If I sample with respect to the row lengths of A, I could lose an epsilon in a subspace somewhere, and then I'm dead. So what I want to do is to sample with respect to probabilities that depend on the lengths of the rows of U. Lengths of the rows of U tell me where the information in A is being sent. It tells me where in the high dimensional space the information in A is being sent. If I sample with those probabilities, meaning bias my tell self towards that space, and choose enough columns, then I'll capture that entire space. If I capture that entire space, I go downstairs, I do size of A computations, pseudo-inversion, and everything's good. I also need some information on where the right-hand side vector B sits relative to the perpendicular component of the column space of A, and that's what that does. But the most interesting thing is that. You need to capture the whole space. All right? In order to choose columns, you do sort of the same thing. Choose a set of probabilities, summing to 1. Choose columns randomly according to those probabilities. And in order SVD of A time, because you're going to have to do the same sort of computation, I can get order k squared columns such that A minus the projection out of those columns of A is relative error good compared to A minus A sub K. Okay. The probabilities I use are analogous, something having to do with row lengths on the other side, cross terms, some other stuff, same intuition. General result, fix K epsilon delta, order SVD time of A, I can get columns and rows such that A minus CUR is relative error good to the best rank K. You have to choose K squared log 1 over delta over epsilon squared, K to the 4th, log 1 over delta, epsilon to the 6th. If you don't like epsilon to the 6th, or epsilon squared for that matter, choose epsilon to be 1, because these are relevant when we're low rank. 1 to the 6th is 1. So choose epsilon to be 1. And as I said, both of those can be made order K.
I gotta ask you, Michael, is O SVD time of A, does that satisfy me?
Do the full SVD and then compute these things. If you can get this information some other way, so this is an inequality, you might be able to do better, I don't know, but big O as an inequality will suffice. If you can get this information some other way, fine. I don't know how to yet.
Oh, right. That's my job, is to get the information, and then that's the getting the information.
Right.
Is included
if, you,
in that.
If you have a model for that.
Okay, if I have the information, then everything's basically free.
Right.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I understand. Right, so we can get the
all right.
The
so
information being the piece.
Right.
Right. So we can get
all right, so I'm going to skip. There's a whole line of previous CUR type things I'll skip. Non-negativity, I'll skip. This is some stuff with Petros Trinaeus and Lai-Kang Lim, who's here this week. The issue is that the columns are non-negative. It's not clear how to do that. There's a convexity structure. We have some conjectures. But let me get to a couple applications. I'm not going to talk about internet applications right now. There's some work in progress, but it's not quite mature enough. I was hoping to have some preliminary stuff, but I don't have that yet. So for now, term document matrices, user group recommendation systems. What I want to talk about, there's also some stuff is two biological applications. There's some stuff on DNA microarrays with Orly Alter and fMRI data with Francois Maillard. I'm not going to do that today. Depending on time, I'm going to talk about DNA SNP data and hyperspectral image data. SNP data is with Perry Peshaw and Ken Kidd, who are at Yale. And the hyperspectral image data is with Mauro Maggioni and Rafi Koifman, also at Yale. All right, so this sort of framework will apply to a number of internet documents, and what I want to do is to walk you through some biological data or documents, if you like, where it will apply. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the application area just to show you a few peculiarities about these two particular application areas where this is nice. So you might know about DNA microarrays. DNA microarrays are, you look at some organism, it could be humans or some yeast or something, and you have on the order of 10,000 genes. In people it's 30,000, in yeast it's 6,000. And you look at it at a number of environmental conditions, which is as big as you can make it. This is a little bit different. What that will give you is very coarse genomic information. But you know, when you walk into the doctor's office, of course, what you're interested in is not what most people are like. You want to know why you're there. And so you want to know a particular thing about you, potentially your environment, but insofar as the genetic makeup is the issue, particular thing about you that is maybe causative or correlative of the particular condition. So the way to look at that is variations between genomes of different people. There's a number of different structures that will account for those variations, insertions, deletions, microsatellites. The most common is known as a SNP, single nucleotide polymorphism. Right, at the single nuclei site, some fraction of people, arbitrarily choosing cutoff, say 1%, at least 1% of people have one nucleotide, and at least 1% have another nucleotide. So it occurs at a single site, and some polymorphic variation there. These are at known locations in the human genome, and you may have two alternative alleles, which are basically DNA variations. So the original data will have, will be two nucleotide sites, one from each parent, and in most cases, you'll get the same thing from both parents because all humans have the same thing. At some positions, SNP sites that are known and are being determined, some fraction of the people will have one or the other, or one of each, depending on their parents. Depending on how you define the minor allele frequency, there's about 10 million, which means about 1 in 1,000 sites people differ at. There's interest here for population genetics reasons, and because it's thought that aside from a small fraction of diseases that can be linked to one or a very small number of genes, the genetic predispositions for a wide range of common diseases will be encoded in polymorphic variations, the most expensive of which are these SNPs. The HapMap project, if you know anything about this, is the main project. Funding from everywhere, pharmaceutical companies, obviously NSF. Why is the Department of Justice interested in this? So I saw this and wondered why this was. So we all watch whatever, CSI or something. I actually don't do this. You get a blood sample or something. Can you identify the ethnicity of a subject from his DNA? So that's why I guess the Department of Justice is interested in this. So there's correlations. Look at just this top piece for now. Ignore the rest. There's correlations amongst different SNPs that have to do with the fact that some SNPs are closer to or farther from each other along the chromosome. And those correlations are heavily dependent on where you are on the chromosome, the particular ethnic group and the subpopulation that you come from. So the question is, can you find a small set of sort of representative SNPs? If you think of these things as terms and documents, the SNPs are the terms, the people are the documents. But can you find a small number of representative SNPs? Representative defined, however. Can you find a small number of individuals that are representative that capture some notion of diversity? What you do not want here is eigen-SNPs. In fact, existing literature, there are some linear algebra-based methods, but you don't want eigen-SNPs. And the reason you don't want eigen-SNPs is because you're not going to be able to type a linear combination of 10 million SNPs. And you don't want eigen-people, because what you really want to know is the problem with you. So you want particular SNPs and particular people, so particular rows and columns in particular. The particular data we looked at was interesting because it was a fairly worldwide population. So 38 different populations, average size. So the HapMap is on the order of 400 individuals at on the order of 5 or 10 million sites. We're looking at that. The stuff I'll talk about is from 38 populations, much smaller, 50 different subjects, and we looked at 63 SNPs each. SNPs are drawn from one chromosomal region, million base pairs, long arm of chromosome 17. And as I said before, at each SNP location, you'll have two alternative nuclei bases or alleles, by definition, effectively. If there was only one, it wouldn't be a SNP. So this will be the data. And what we want to do, well, I guess on the next slide, this is where the data come from. All over the world, effectively. Not a uniform distribution, because you might want outliers. I don't think Iceland's in this data set, but a lot of Native American Indians are similarly genetically homogenous, so you may know about Iceland. So just similarly, analogously genetically homogenous as it down here. And so they'll have interesting information that other groups might not have. So we want to take the original data and put it into a matrix. For right now, we want to put it into a plus one, minus one, zero matrix. This, I mean, really the ball game's here, you know, the encoding of the data. If you encode it the right way, you turn the crank and you'll get something. And if you don't encode it the right way, you'll get nothing. So I want to gloss over why we did this. It's one of those things that's obvious in retrospect, but not obvious beforehand. Exactly two out of the nucleotides occur. That's known. You can look in a book and tell which two. So if two alleles are both equal, set them to be plus one. If they're both equal to the first nucleotide, if they're both equal to the second, say minus one, if both different, call them zero. That's arbitrary and doesn't matter because they're going to correspond to a sign of a single vector, so we're going to be dealing with norms. So that doesn't matter.
Sorry, Mike, I missed the cardinality of the rows and columns?
For the HapMap data I'm not talking about today, it's on the order of 400 individuals by 5 million, say 5 or 10 million rows and columns. This data set is where each of the populations is about 100. This data set is on the order of 2,000, I think it was 1963 because we had to throw some stuff out. 2,000 people, 63 SNPs. And each population is on the order of 50 people. So to justify, so you can use a lot of heavy machinery here in terms of expectation maximization and a range of other statistical learning algorithms have been applied. As a sanity check, we want to see that there is, in fact, correlation in low-rank structure here. So let's do the SVD and see what K will give us 90% of the variance. So we do that. And then we're going to choose a small number of columns. Factors of 10 and 100 here matter, so we're not going to use a naive implementation of the randomized strategy, but it's a greedy heuristic based on it. How many columns will give us the same fraction? And what we'll see, I guess I'll say with the algorithm is exactly, we'll choose the best SNP in a multi-pass manner, and that's related to the algorithm where you decrease the added error exponentially with the number of passes. It's effectively a greedy variant of that. So to get 90% of the variance, these X's will give you what SVD gives you, so you need, in some of the American Indian populations, you know, 3 or 4 or 5. For some of the Africans, by which we don't mean African Americans, they're actually very interesting because there was some convergent recombination in those populations. But by African, I mean sub-Saharan African populations tend to need quite a bit more in the order of 20 or 30. I'm not claiming that linear structure extraction methods are most appropriate here, but as a first pass, let's look at that.
They need 20 columns to get the same performance.
No, SVD.
Rank 20. SVD needs 20, okay.
If you want to choose columns, that's the circles.
Okay.
So, same number of columns, one more column, four, three more columns.
Okay.
So, a small number of extra columns.
Okay.
All right, and that's not at all peculiar to the data set.
But it don't.
Most everything else I've looked at.
So this is the statement you made earlier that the penalty you actually pay in practice is.
Isn't anything. Okay. Yeah. But that also has to do with the particular greedy procedure
yeah,
and how we think about it.
Right.
Yeah. But it's. And that's why I said small, you know, oversampled by a bit or a bit in practice and in theory may mean something different.
Yep.
Now, what we really want to do is to do the following. And this is not at all peculiar to SNPs if you're dealing with these term document matrices. Or recommendation systems, as I said before, there's missing entries, or you want to make some sort of prediction. So what we want to view is the matrix this way, all right? So let's take this and partition in. These are the SNPs, and those are the individuals. And we'll assume that we have all this information, and we assume that we have all this information. What you really want to do is take some new individual, you'll ping them or type them in a small number of spots, and predict this, predict something out here, all right? So the question is, can we do that? And we'll do that effectively with an L2 reconstruction, which is what CUI is going to be giving you. So we'll have a small number of SNPs, a small number of people, and we want to extrapolate. New person comes in, new SNP, type them at the basis set of SNPs, the dictionary of SNPs, and compare them to the dictionary of people. So you're extrapolating along people and along SNPs, users and goods. A straw man, although they don't call it that, is sometimes called uniform sampling. So if you want to do things stupidly, you certainly can fail. And this will show that if you implement something naively, you'll get garbage. So for example, for certain populations in the reconstruction era, about 40% or something, which is much too large. The number 40 shouldn't mean anything to you, but for this particular application, state of the art is 40% is not so good. But 20% is okay. If you choose the subjects judiciously, the SNPs will assume they're fixed, but you can also choose them judiciously. You'll see that the for keeping these numbers are arbitrary, 20% of the SNPs, and we put half the subject into a training, half the subjects into a test set. You'll get reconstruction errors on the order of zero, but, which is makes sense here because these are fairly homogeneous. I don't know why that's so low, but to something on the order of 10 or 15%, maybe 20%.
That's not surprising, right?
And that makes perfect sense. We're predicting along two axes here. So individuals and SNPs. So we're doing a fair amount of extrapolation.
Right, but the question is, how do you choose subjects judiciously?
How do you choose subjects here is based on the strategies like I was talking about.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, it's not surprising that you pull that down. That makes perfect sense. Right. But the point is that if you choose them reasonably intelligently, you can get variance which competes with state of the art in this particular application domain.
So, and if you had computed the SPDs, you will get comparable to the red circles, or completely lost.
You can't do the SVD. And the reason you can't do the SVD is because you can't type an eigencombination of people. If you want to do the SVD, it's a training and test set, it's all on your machine. You could do that and you get something comparable. But you really want to use information just from a small number of people and just from a small number of goods. Because this, you can't take everyone and type everywhere. So that's why I said we can't. Obviously, for the training, we have all the data in front of us. But I mean, the point is that in this and a range of other applications, you want to respect them.
So you could have computed the SVD of the people that you picked and the rows that you picked.
Right.
But then it's a completely equivalent.
Right. That's effectively what's going on. That's effectively what's going on.
You do a sparse QR.
So Pete Stewart has something which is structurally very similar to CUR,
right.
And he uses, if you're familiar with that, very similar ideas, and we're actually looking at that. And
okay. He has an error analysis.
It's sort of a backwards error analysis, different than an a priori, but a backwards error analysis. That's actually very nice, and it's hard to sell random strategies to
certain people.
So this is a nice way to get around that, and it performs well, which it should because it's by design.
From the numbers that you said a little while ago, it seems that the HapMap project is spending $250,000 per subject with 400 subjects. So can you use a variation of this method to be more judicious about which individuals you should spend $250,000 to get the maximum amount of information from?
Yeah, so I mean, the individuals are chosen using an awful lot of field-specific knowledge. There's some sub-Saharan African, there's a Japanese population, there's a Chinese, but Chinese is a very heterogeneous group, and a population of individuals in Utah from European descent. And those were chosen to, on a first pass, sort of cover a lot of bases, but by no means is that the
final word. Say you start with your 100 people from Utah, and you could measure just 63 SNPs for those 100 people,
right.
And then decide which ones are worth measuring all their other SNPs.
Right. Mm-hmm. When the Human Genome Project was proposed in the 80s, people said this isn't the way to spend money because more or less for these sorts of reasons, and it was done, for better or for worse. When applied to particular studies, people certainly use the sort of intuition you're talking about, but at a sort of a global scale, that, so far as I know, hasn't been done, but maybe they use some sort of bootstrapping procedure like that. So just in the last little bit here, let me quickly go over an application to image analysis. And so what I want you to think about here is that you're going to have an image. There can be a tensor-based extension of it. We're sort of working through the details of that. But you'll have an image. It could be an MRI image. It's time-resolved. Could be a hyperspectral image. Satellite plane or something goes over and looks at the picture of the ground. at a large number, very fine frequency resolution, a large number of frequencies. These particular ones will be medical samples, same sort of thing, a very fine gradation in frequencies. Ignore the tensor structure. View this as a vector. In this is 500 by 500, so you have a vector in R 250k, and you have on the order of 100 of these guys. And so, if you look at a single pixel, this is a column here. Look at a single pixel, call that a row. This is a vector in R about 100. There's an awful lot of redundancy here, and so the question is, can you apply these ideas to extract that information out? Now, the point here is that you don't want to do SVD because that may not, I'll show why that is, but you may have a lot of understanding as to what's going on at this frequency, because this frequency corresponds to some particular physical phenomenon you understand. And you may have a lot of understanding as to what goes on at that bit, because you could have something else here in the spatial correlation, so you know what this bit is. You know what this frequency is. So you want to have a dictionary of frequencies and a dictionary of fibers or of pixels. So columns are these slabs, rows are these fibers, the time resolved, the frequency resolved, pixels. So the chosen images will be a dictionary, and again, just as with the SNPs and the term document things I was mentioning, it's a dictionary from the data to express every image. The chosen pixels will be a dictionary from the data to express every pixel. The data will look something like the following. You want this and not that. That's a bad thing. This is a colon specimen, and that's non-cancerous, and that's cancerous. Long story short, you want to reconstruct these things and resolve those distinctions. Now, in terms of how you construct the sample, you may say the fact that this is dark and that's light is an artifact of the particular staining method you use and so on. So you might not want to bias it in some naive way. So we'll sample uniformly, let's say, on the pixels, and non-uniformly on the slabs. And again, that's motivated by intuition from the field. And this is what the distribution, I have 128. This is what the distribution as a function of frequency, corresponding to total intensity absorbed. This is cancerous nuclei. This is normal. And obviously, if you look at all of them, you have a curve pretty similar to this. These are different. And it's the job of machine learning people to resolve those differences. But they're certainly not orthogonal. So if you do SVD, one of these vectors is sitting here in R128. One of these vectors is sitting here. You want to resolve that difference. If you do an SVD analysis, you pull out that guy, and you pull out that guy. I should point out, the whole point of the diffusion wavelets is not to do an SVD analysis. So that's not what they're doing, but other people have looked at that. But that's certainly not the sort of thing you want to be doing. The top couple eigenvectors will look something like this. There'll be oscillations everywhere. Certainly not anything like you saw on the previous slide. And these are eigenfaces. And this is effectively eigenanalysis on those samples. I was trying to be polite and not say it, but exactly. So what we want is a dictionary, not of eigenfaces or of eigenvectors here, but in terms of the actual data. So we can do that. And let's choose arbitrarily a small number of slabs. We're going to choose two or three. And I'll choose some slab to reconstruct. I chose the 65th because it was far from all the ones you randomly chose, but more other than that, it's just arbitrary. And this is the exact slab. And if we sample two or three slabs, two or three images, on the order of 1,000 pixels, and reconstruct the 65th, so we're using slabs 41 and 50 in this particular application, which you see the same thing elsewhere, and you reconstruct the 65th using these, in this case, two vectors in high dimensions. Two vectors as a basis, on the order of 1,000 pixels. One reason why we need so many pixels, as opposed to two, which all you need is in a linear algebraic sense, is because you saw the scan, there's a lot of noise on the spectrum. So the noise actually dominates the difference until you get quite a few to denoise. And what you see is this. Now this, certainly by eye, is to first approximation the same. Maybe lights, the resolution's not perfect, but what you can see is here, you'll pick up a lot of structure here. Maybe the lights aren't so good down here. And that'll be a denoising effect because we're going down to a much lower intermediate dimension. On the other hand, right here, let's say, you lose some information. So there's an interplay here between denoising and losing information, which isn't surprising. And that's matrix reconstruction, effectively tissue classification. Here's the exact data. Red and blue and green will correspond to the three different classes. All of these are blue. But because if you look at a single pixel, it's hard to resolve. There's a lot of noise there. Choose on the order. Now we need to choose a couple extra. Choose 12. Same number of fibers. What you'll see is you get denoised classification there. And out here, it'll be quite a bit noisier. And that's the same phenomenon here applied to the classification problem. So I glossed through, ran through the two applications rather quickly, just not to run over. But in summary, what we have is decomposition or class of decompositions that provide a mechanism, let's say, to define dictionaries in terms of the data that's applicable to a diverse range of document domains. Low-rank approximation terms the columns and rows, and the idea is that you know something about the columns and rows, and you want to take advantage of the field from which the data are drawn, and it's effectively an approximate least squares fitting. You can ask about other sorts of fittings, and we'll think about that, but all this is in a least squares framework, and SNPs and spectrally resolved in a whole bunch of internet data sets that we're looking at applying it to. And of course, I mean, more generally, the question is how to, in some sense, put some of the burden back on the algorithm people in order to develop algorithmic methods that will couple well with people's understanding of fields, but not be peculiar to particular data sets. So, thanks for your attention.